Yeah, I'd like to know.
Start off here.
Yes.
We'll go and call the meeting order so we get a quorum.
Hello, everybody. Listen, I wanted to have a hearing on UI unemployment insurance because our office has been getting a number of calls from all over, and I know that other legislators have also told me that they have been getting calls. And so I'm hoping, you know, to hear what some of the complaints are and then possibly how we can address them. So we'll start off first with the folks that have been having the problems, and then we'll end up with Deed and any other comments from committee members. So I'm going to start off with Paul Marquez. Paul, did I say your name right? Why don't you come up to the table and whoever else is coming with you, and you folks can sit down and identify yourselves, and then just go ahead and start off and feel comfortable. We're pretty freewheeling here, and this is your committee room, so don't be nervous.
Okay.
I'm really a nice guy.
Contrary to everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You did.
Go ahead. Welcome to the committee and just say your name.
My name is Paul Marquez. I'm a commercial painter. I lost my job in November of 2008 when the company I worked for closed the doors. I was lucky enough to catch on with another company a week later after I lost my job. As times got tough and work was slow, I was one of the first ones to get laid off because I was new to the company. Each time I was called back, I went to work. Whether it was one day or 5 days a week, I went back to work. Because of this, I was only able to work 6 months out of the year last year. This is a big problem with the trades right now. When times are good, people are working. When it's slow, they call you back for a week or 2 weeks or whatever, and then you get laid off. I've been fortunate to work the past 18 years and stayed working full time. When I got laid off this last time, I received $566 a week, max benefits. When my year was up from 2008 to 2009, they redid my benefits, and because I only worked 6 months out of the year, my benefits dropped to $377. So now I'm sitting at $377, not knowing that I couldn't get an extension at the higher rate because I had to reapply for benefits after a year. At $377, it's tough to make the bills. And if I work less this year, it's going to go down even more. So I'm just like, my hands are tied. I don't know what else to do.
Well, Paul, first of all, were you your own contractor?
I'm a union member.
So you're a member of whatever?
Local 386.
386, okay. And I wonder, and we'll get into it later, but you had to, did you meet a yearly deadline where then you were told by Deed that you had to reapply?
Reapply, and then I had to have another waiting week again.
To see if you qualified for state, re-qualified for state unemployment insurance instead of staying on the federal extension, right?
I never got the extension. Never received the extension.
You never ever got the federal extension?
No, because once my year was up, they said I had to reapply, and then I got no extension. So I went right into a new claim.
Okay.
So that it dropped from 566 down to 377.
So you were, I just want to be clear, that make sure that I'm clear. The whole time you were on unemployment insurance, you were on the state UI and no federal extension at all?
Right.
Okay. And who?
This is my wife, Kathy. She just wants to explain a few other things.
Kathy, welcome to the committee, and you'll have to say your name for the tape.
My name is Kathy Marquez, and this is my husband, and I can honestly say that I've never had to collect unemployment, so I've never been touched by it before. If you've never been touched by a problem, you really don't know that it exists. There are many people not touched by unemployment, so they really don't know what impact it has on your life. But there are a lot of people that are touched by it and can see that we need change. How do you go from $30 an hour to $9 an hour, still pay taxes on it, and then try to make your mortgage? Times are not normal. Unemployment, it works, but it needs to be adjusted to help people survive during these difficult times. Maximum benefit, $566 a week. New claims benefit for Paul is $377 a week, plus he has another waiting week. His employment it hasn't changed. His hourly rate hasn't changed. The type of work he does hasn't changed. His benefits haven't changed. The only thing that has changed for him is the fact that he can't get the hours because the work is not there. So he's kind of being penalized because he's out there trying to do the work, trying to find the work, working whenever he can, but because he only got 6 months in, his benefits dropped to 377, and now there's no guarantees. If he only works 3 months this next year, they're going to drop even further. He's going to get the waiting week again. That's why I think we need to relook at this during these difficult times. It's not normal times, and I don't see this ending anytime soon. There's a lot of people in this boat. I mean, this is people from all of the trades, whether they're carpenters, plumbers, electricians. They're all in the same boat. If they don't go out and get any work, they stay at the max benefit claim. They don't have to wait that extra week. They just keep right on. As long as the extensions keep coming, they're okay. It's the people like Paul who are going out trying to work because he also needs to keep up his medical insurance. And if he doesn't work, then that will lapse also, and then he has no medical. So I, in my opinion, what I see, I look, extensions are good, and I think in this time of difficulty, that's something that we should have. But I think as far as new claims, I don't think that any of these should be treated as new claims because for the construction, the job that he's in, it's not a new claim. It's not a new job that he went out and got and lost. It's still the same one that he's trying to hold on to.
Okay.
I'd also like to address the taxes that are applied to unemployment benefits. I've never collected unemployment, so I'm really not aware of how much it impacts you, but when your take-home pay is half of what it normally is and then you're taxed on it beside, I don't see how anybody can make it.
Okay, anything else?
No.
From testifiers, any questions at all from the committee? And would the committee like to just go on with the witnesses and then have Deed and Mr. Nelson come up then at that point? Let's do it that way. Thank you very much for your testimony. Now I'm going to call the meeting to order, and Representative Gunther is going to approve the minutes from the April 21st meeting and also from the August 10th meeting that we had. Any additions or corrections? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. And we will call up Lori Gandrud from the, is it Northwest? I guess it's not. Come up, Lori. We've had some problems with some of the flight attendants, too, that have taken, I guess we would call them voluntary leaves, that they thought the problem would be solved, but some of those problems haven't been solved. Lori, welcome to the committee, and then you can have your testifiers introduce themselves as they speak.
Thank you. My name is Lori Gandrud, and I've been a flight attendant with Northwest for 20 years. I also have the privilege of serving our Minneapolis-based flight attendants as a local council rep for the Association of Flight Attendants. And I have three flight attendants here today with me that have taken the voluntary leaves and have had issues with unemployment, and we'll let them tell their story. I'm here today to address some of the issues that our Minnesota-based flight attendants have encountered while on a slip leave and applying for unemployment benefits. I want to thank Representative Rukavina for letting us come here today and share this information with you. And let me share a little bit about how the Special Leave Incentive Program, or SLIP leave, works and the benefits it provides to the state of Minnesota. In the recent past, there have been an overage of flight attendants. The SLIP leave program was designed by the union and agreed to by the company to protect flight attendants from being involuntarily furloughed. The Minnesota unemployment statute was changed in August of 2009 after 2 years of diligent work with state lawmakers from both the House and the Senate. The Association of Flight Attendants persisted and succeeded in educating Minnesota lawmakers of the importance of this issue for our Minnesota-based flight attendants as well as for the state of Minnesota. And the change was allowed for voluntary furloughs to qualify for unemployment benefits. By taking these leaves, senior flight attendants protect the more junior flight attendants from permanently losing their jobs. During a slip leave, the company provides company-paid health insurance for the duration of the leave and provides a return-to-work date. Typically, these leaves are 3, 6, 9 months in duration, and the company also promises not to contest any unemployment claims. Flight attendants in other states, we have 9 bases, 9 domiciles at Northwest. We have this program is offered to all our flight attendants. And Minnesota, up until 09, was the only state that didn't allow a voluntary furlough to receive unemployment benefits. We felt that our Minnesota flight attendants deserve the same benefits as other Northwest flight attendants living and working in other states. It's a great program for the flight attendants and for the state of Minnesota. It's really a win-win situation, and we would appreciate the support and cooperation from the officials in the state to recognize the benefits of this program and see that it has the opportunity to succeed. In September of 09, just a few months ago, we had 274 Minneapolis-based flight attendants apply for the slip leave. The majority of these flight attendants had 20 to 30 years of seniority and had never been unemployed or had never applied for unemployment benefits. There really wasn't any direction or adequate instructions given for their application process or what was expected of them for success. Some mistakes were made. We absolutely admit that. And there were some misunderstandings of the questions and the appropriate answers that were to be answered. I don't know if any of you have gone online to apply for unemployment benefits, but it's quite a process. These applications were, okay, so there were some mistakes made, some misunderstanding of the questions. The applications where the mistakes were made were then automatically denied, and the flight attendants were required to schedule an appeal hearing by phone with an unemployment law judge. It's a bit intimidating and nerve-wracking for many of these flight attendants. Might have been easier and less expensive if the applicants could have just corrected their mistakes instead of being forced into the appeal process. Some of these appeals were overturned at that appeal process, but many were not. 2 months into the program, 59 of our flight attendants had not gotten any benefits. 3 months into the program, 28 still had not gotten any benefits. And they had to apply for, they go through the denial process and then they have to apply for reconsideration. 30, 60, 90 days, that's a long time to not receive any income. And remember, these flight attendants are trying to prevent permanent layoffs of more junior flight attendants, saving the state of Minnesota long-term indefinite unemployment benefits to the junior flight attendants that are still employed, and the health care is being paid by the company. So it's really a good program. Unlike many other unemployment applicants, our union was able to assist our members, and we scheduled a meeting in November with Representative Rukavina. He included Lee Nelson of Deed and Keith Goodwin of Unemployment to discuss these issues. After that meeting, many of the 28 outstanding issues were resolved, with many accepting partial benefits. And what I mean by that is a lot of these people were kind of taken care of, their benefits were started, but they were not able to receive retro pay for the weeks that they had missed or the months that they had missed. There are many unemployment judges that hear these appeals and decide if a person is following the law. There are many interpretations of the applicable statute and subjective and inconsistent decisions. There are also many different people that assist in customer service and many different approaches to the advice given. We're hoping that together we can bring awareness to the special benefits of the SLIP program and try to make the benefits more accessible to our group and make that program appealing to our flight attendants so they continue to apply for a slip leave and prevent junior flight attendants from being laid off, because we are still in an overage. There will probably still be an overage of flight attendants. Furloughs are possible. If we can get the slip leave program to work, our flight attendants will apply for them and take them. With that being said, I would just like to share a few situations that I witnessed on phone appeals or perhaps was informed of. I've just got a couple, and then I'll let these three tell their stories of their denials and their appeals. Rose, she asked some advice by customer service on what to say to potential employers about the fact that she has a start date to go back to work. And she was told, don't tell the employers that you're going back to your job. John, he checked the wrong box for why he was separating from his employer. He checked the non-medical leave box, which takes you to a whole nother drop down. He He was denied. It took 2 months for him. He finally contacted Mr. Palenti, and his account was paid in full. Now that non-medical leave is not an option, which is a good thing. Mybrit, she is in her 60s. She lives in a small town. She's not experienced or trained for many other jobs. She's on a three-month leave, and she had to go through the appeal process, the denial process, the reconsideration process, and she was finding it really hard to put gas in her car, to go to these applications and seek jobs in other towns because she was in such a small town. And she was going back to work in 90 days. Ellen was asked, why haven't you gone to Super Target? There's a nice Trader Joe's down in Woodbury. Have you gone to Career Builder? And Ellen said, I'm not very computer savvy. I don't know that stuff. And the judge said, have you thought of retreating? And Ellen said, I really haven't. I think I might be too old. And the judge asked, how old? And Ellen said, I'm 67. And Ms. Law, and the judge said, oh, Ms. Law, there are really nice restaurants in Woodbury. Those are similar to flight attendant jobs. And then Connie was told that she had to go to a job-seeking interview in Burnsville. She had to work on her resume, and she had to discuss a job search. And again, Connie was going back to work. She had a start date. Kathleen applied for retail jobs, sales positions, clerical positions. The judge asked her, have you applied for temporary work? And she said, no, I just was applying for jobs. And the judge said she wasn't actively seeking suitable employment. That went on for a very long time. And then my last example here is Donna. And Donna has not received 1 cent yet. She filled out her work search online. She thought that was sufficient. Again, this is an older woman who's never been on unemployment. After her denial letter, the appeal judge asked her for the log. She said she put it in on the computer and she didn't have it written down. He asked her to fax it in. She did. They couldn't find it. She called customer service, told her that they received thousands of faxes a day. They couldn't find it. She then filed for reconsideration. I believe that conversation was cut off in 10 minutes with the judge saying, get a job or change your circumstances. Well, she got a job at Home Store. She gets paid $7.25 an hour. She believes that constitutes a circumstance change, and she still hasn't received a penny from unemployment. So, actually, I do have one more here. Linda was, the last question the judge asked her was, what are you doing with your time off? And she said, well, I have grandchildren, they sleep over every now and then, and I live with my father. And the judge, after the phone call, she was denied because the judge stated that she did home health care. Now, I just, on Friday, went to an appointment with one of our, we have 2010 slip leaves now that just started in January, and one of our girls was required to go to a career change seminar. Again, she has a start date. She's coming back in 3 months. I just think there's probably other people out there that might need those benefits. And I think our flight attendant group, I don't know what else to say. I've got just some flight attendants here that will tell you their story. Mike Ewald will start.
Hello.
Mike, why don't you just identify yourself, Dave?
My name is Mike Ewald, and I work for Delta Airlines. I am a instructor and a flight attendant. I'll just give you a little bit of the overview of what took place when I applied for unemployment through this slip leave in order to keep a junior person from getting laid off. I first applied online, and the computer program apparently doesn't always work real well. I had heard this because I had went down to the workforce center in Chaska, and they had told me that a lot of times when people apply online, the application says that it's accepted, but it doesn't get accepted. Mine was one of those that did not get accepted as well, so I had to go back and reapply again. I did reapply, and I was denied for unemployment because I was told that I was ineligible because I was doing an inactive, or how do they explain it here? I was not actively searching for work. I did fax unemployment my job sheets that I had developed, since they didn't have any for me, saying who I had contacted, when I had contacted them, what type of job I was looking for, what the results were, things of that nature. I also had to fill out a what they call a fax sheet, which on there they had then made the determination that I still was not qualified because they said that I wrote on there that I was not willing to take employment, which I have my fact sheet here. And once I did go to my unemployment hearing with the law judge 60 days later, it was resolved quite rapidly. So I'm thankful for that. And she actually did reverse everything and pay me my back pay. But I guess my experience with unemployment was the information that the unemployment people were giving me when I contacted them the three or four times was that I was supposed to follow my handbook. Well, in the handbook, it's, I haven't seen it for a couple months, so I apologize for that. I didn't realize I was coming down here until this morning. But in the handbook, it's got like a three sentences, and basically it says something to the effect of you need to look for employment, even if you're on a part-time job or you're going back to work, something like that, but you need to look for work. It does not say that you have to document all your work search. It doesn't say that you have to look for activities in different fields. When I went before the law judge, I was asked, you know, what activities I was looking at, what types of jobs. They wanted me to be looking at jobs at like Super Target, at, you know, maybe fast food restaurants, clothing retailers, airlines, you know, railroads. The list goes on and on. It wasn't just looking for something that you've been working in for the last 10 years, but they wanted you to broaden your horizons and look in different areas as well. So I think that kind of summarizes it.
Okay, thank you very much, and we'll just listen to all of them and then take questions if there are any. Next, then, please.
Hi, my name is Amy Lusty. I'm a 20-year flight attendant, Northwest, now you know, or Delta. I applied for the slip leave, the six-month leave, knowing my husband has a job and it was good timing for me. I took it because I knew that a junior person at our company would keep their job. That's why I took the job, or took the leave. My story is, I'll just be factual about it. I've been going to school for about 3 years, working towards my CEUs to keep my teaching license up. I'm a licensed teacher, K through 12, and flight attendant also, and I have to get so many CEUs to keep my license, so I've been going to school doing that, and then the credits are going towards my master's. I checked the box that said I was going to school, and it said, are you willing to quit? I said no at the time because I didn't know if I talked to my professor, and she said she would let me take the night class if I did get a job. So at the time, I had checked that I couldn't quit at the time because I pay about $1,200 per class. So I was denied because I wasn't willing to quit that class. I did the appeal with the appeal judge. We talked for about 35, 40 minutes on the phone, and I missed out on about 2 weeks of unemployment benefits because I didn't have a written documentation that I had applied for a job earlier in that month. And I finally did get the unemployment benefits, and I had to do a work search plan. I've attended about five workforce center classes since I've been off, and applied for several jobs over this time period, and I will be returning to work March 2nd. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. And welcome.
My name is Dawn Shea, and I've been a flight attendant for 22 years with Northwest and now with Delta Airlines. Just got back from Atlanta last night. Spent some time with a very good friend of mine who, I don't know if anybody recalls this, was a survivor of Flight 242 in 1977, where 72 people lost their lives. I'm going to try not to get too emotional. But when people say we're qualified to do banquet waitress jobs, that offends me. And I'm going to try to just get a little less emotional here and just tell you the facts of what happened to me. I took a 3-month sleep leave, and the reason why I took the sleep leave was that I was assured that I would retain my benefits and that I would receive unemployment benefits. And the reason I took the leave, I thought long and hard about it, but it was 22 years and I felt that I needed to take a leave, and I also needed to help save junior people's jobs. I have many friends that are junior flight attendants. I also did have some health issues that I thought 3 months might help resolve. I was denied for about a month, about 5 weeks. Okay, I did go through the appeal process, and I still do have an ongoing issue. I'm a little nervous about this, but I think a lot of us just misunderstood the process. When I filled out the unemployment application, I did it on September 1st, which was the very first day of the leave. It was a day that I was actually working an international trip, and I filled out the application immediately. I put an X in the wrong box. I put that I wasn't looking for work, because I wasn't looking for work that day. I was actually working a trip. So I was one of the ones that sort of misunderstood the process of this slip leave. And consequently, I have not received those 5 weeks of pay. I did start receiving pay due to evidence that I had sent in of job applications. I did look in my community. I was on a 3-month leave. I'm sorry, I'm a little static, I'm a little nervous, but that's the long and short of it. I put the X in the wrong box, and I feel that the penalty that I am paying for this does not fit the crime. And that's all I have to say.
And if I could just wrap that up with one paragraph here. There just seems to be many different ways to interpret the unemployment statute, and it allows for unfair and unequal treatment of the applicants. Some applicants received full benefits, some received partial, and some received none. So, again, thank you very much for listening to our issues.
Other questions, but I do, on the slip leave, you don't get any kind of supplemental benefits other than your health benefits, or do you?
You continue to accrue your sick time, your vacation, and you retain your health care.
But as far as any financial?
No.
Okay. Representative Anders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are you allowed to shorten your slip leave if you wanted to, if, say, you decided you didn't want to?
No.
Okay, so you commit to, is it three months that you're committed to?
My husband was getting really nervous. I didn't get anything for 2 months, and I called. You couldn't do anything. You had to continue with the leave.
Okay, and Mr. Chair?
Go ahead.
And is it typically a 90-day time period, or is it how long is a typical slip leave, or is it?
What I've seen, the history, it's three. The one in 2009 was 3, 6, and 9, and the 2010 is 3 and 4 months. It's all different. It all varies.
Okay, and Mr. Chair?
Go ahead.
So what happens when you come back, then? Are those junior members, are they then cut, or how does that work?
Our 2009 slip leaves basically rolled right into 2010. They offered the leaves in November for 2010. So people were coming back from their 3, 6, and 9. Well, 3 and 6 were probably back. They still knew there was an overage, so they offered 3 and 4. They offered to extend the 9-month if they didn't get enough of a response from new applicants. But they were able to fulfill what they needed to take care of the overage. That'll take us through April, end of April. And they're projecting summer flying. We'll all come back from our leave. We'll all fly. I mean, who knows really what's going to happen, but.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, do we know how Minnesota compares in the slip leave unemployment benefit payment? How do we compare to other states? Do we know that at all?
Or? We'll ask Mr. Nelson of that, but okay. According to what Lori said, the other states have not had the problems at all that Minnesota's had. Now, I don't know if you're asking financially or what your question is, or if you're asking, you know, how it works out I guess, structurally or bureaucratically, they haven't had these problems in the other 9 states where it's offered, you say?
We have 9 other domiciles.
Okay.
I think it's where they live.
So, but if I didn't answer you, Representative Anderson, you can ask Mr. Nelson or whoever else is going to be coming up later. Representative Nornes.
Mr. Chair, I wasn't familiar with this program. Is this unique to the airline industry, or I'd never heard of this type of a benefit before?
The slip leave was, it was just...
Negotiated.
Our union thought up the idea of it, brought it to the company, it was agreed upon. I took a slip leave back in 1992, back when one of our wars was happening. There was no issue back then. Somewhere between, you know, the early 90s and the mid, you know, a couple years ago, something changed with voluntary and involuntary. So the special leave incentive program is, I think, unique to Northwest Airlines, actually.
Thanks.
Yep.
Okay. Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess this discussion so far harkens back to, you know, constituent issues I had a whole year ago that I brought to you. And I guess I'm hoping, after hearing the issues, particularly with the appeals process and the use of judges and the time that folks are waiting, those are the same issues that I was hearing over a year ago, not related to the slip leave, but just related to constituents who weren't filling out the form properly or didn't have anyone to talk to about the form, and so they get the denial and then have to appeal. And I guess I'm hoping that the department, when they come up, can talk to us a little bit about, and we talked about this a year ago, how much it would cost to have a staff follow up with people on a phone call as opposed to all the appeals that end up in court, and where the cost savings is. I can't help but think that a lower paid person to follow up to help someone fill out those forms properly would have erased a problem that didn't need to go pay a judge and take all that time and backlog the system. So I'm hoping we get those answers, but what I'm hearing right now is really just a mirror of the issues of a year ago.
Well, Representative Norton, you know, I have asked the department the same question, if there couldn't be some kind of an intermediate step example where a supervisor might look at a decision made by someone else before, or at least look at the application process, even when it's denied, before it gets to an you know, unemployment comp appeals judge. Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers, I guess I'm wondering if this seems like it's an agreed-upon program that's between you and your employer, and it seems to work really well, except for when you have to go through the unemployment benefits. And I'm just wondering, is there a special box on the form for flight attendants who've taken a slip leave? It seems like that could really help the problem. And maybe it could flag for deed, you know, that special program, and they could look and see if you filled out the form correctly. Then the other question is, I just see some possible answers here. And the other question is, are the flight attendants then working internally to come up with a kind of a, you know, a guide to give to the flight attendants when they go on slip leave to tell them how to answer the questions? Is that being done now?
Well,
go ahead.
We did request a packet of the little red book so we could get those to our flight attendants 30 days, perhaps 60 days before their leave, and talk to all of them and let them know, check the voluntary leave box, you have to be available and seeking work. We never did get the little red book. We weren't able to address our members ahead of time. We do via email. We send out blast emails. With Delta now, we're required to do quite a bit of training. Training is a whole nother can of worms in the unemployment arena, because if you say you're getting paid for a day of training, it's a whole nother group of windows and questions and answers. And there was actually somebody that Mariah, I think, that helped one of our flight attendants, who sent that to me in a document, and I send that out to all our flight attendants. You know, there's a blast that goes out. If you have training, let me know. I will help walk you through the information to try to get them as easily through the unemployment process when they have training. And I love your question about could there be a drop down for slip leave. You know, there's people out there that do construction. I talked to somebody today who they go to their office, they go to the union office, they fill out their paperwork, that's it, they're done. Because they know they're going to get recalled. They don't have to do anything. You know, we have a definite start date. This program saves the state money. I think there should be some incentive to try to simplify the program. Thank you.
And members, you know, there are other union contracts where I think we've tried to address through unemployment insurance where they've taken voluntary leave ahead of their other junior, less senior members so they could stay working and keep getting benefits. But I think a lot of it has to do with the company cooperating too, and in some instances I know of, they didn't really want to cooperate, so it caused problems. But in this case, the company was cooperating and very agreeable to this program, but it just happened, you know, that our computer system is a computer system. And Andy, if you remember a year ago or whenever it was, a year and a half ago when the system went online, we had the one Teamster that worked for the school district. They were Teamsters, remember? And said, are you a school employee? And he said, yes. Well, then that kicked it out because teachers don't get, and others get laid off in the summer, and he didn't get unemployment for months, too, because a computer can't. I mean, it's only as good as the human being that programmed it. So that's why I've tried to have human beings there, but that hasn't been. Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And a question. Do you think the transition going from Northwest to Delta complicated this whole issue?
I don't think that had anything to do with it, honestly. And any input?
No.
Because we are still Northwest flight attendants. We are still under the Northwest contract. This is an agreement with AFA and the Northwest Company, so this really has nothing to do with Delta. I do fear, you know, a year down the road, how this might work. We have union representational issues coming and all that, but no, that's not part of it at all.
Okay. Then we may call you back up to when after Deed is talking. Thank you. Any other questions at all? Thank you very much. Then we have Mr. Charles Thomas from Legal Services. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Thomas.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Charles Thomas. I'm an attorney with Southern Minnesota Regional Legal Services, called Smurls in our territory, from Mankato. Legal Services gives free legal assistance to low-income people. We steadily get requests for assistance from people who have a problem with their unemployment benefits. Our program probably advises several hundred people a year on these cases. We do handle some hearings, and our staff have taken some cases through to the Court of Appeals. What I want to raise today are some questions whether there's enough fairness in our unemployment system. My perspective is as a lawyer who represents people wanting unemployment benefits, so that is the position of an advocate. But I've been working on unemployment cases for a long time, long enough to perceive that there has been a change in the system to where it is not as fair to the worker as it once was. The department now each year disqualifies, I think, about 50,000 people in Minnesota who apply for unemployment benefits. The department will have the exact numbers. The department's judges conduct about 20,000 hearings each year requested by people after they're denied benefits. Something less than half of these folks win their hearings. Hardly any of these folks have an attorney. I need to tell you that the clients whose cases I see are not members of unions. These are just individual workers versus their employer. The individual workers often do not know how to marshal their evidence, how to present documents and testimony for their case. They don't know how to cross-examine the employer's witnesses, and they get flustered when the judge interrupts and says, now you have to ask questions, not give your testimony. Somehow these folks I see seem to have all missed that class in high school about how to present evidence in front of an administrative tribunal. Not everyone feels like they get a fair hearing over the phone. It doesn't look like a hearing, and it doesn't feel like a real hearing. And often seems just like luck when you win. There used to be a difference between what a worker did that got them fired from their job and what they would have to do to also lose their unemployment benefits, which means, in many cases, facing poverty. This space or this gap between what are grounds for discharge and what's misconduct that's grounds for denying unemployment has gotten smaller and smaller, tipping much more in favor of the employer. Now, almost any error or mistake by a worker can be spun as misconduct if the employer has a rule or a policy about it. Let me just try to illustrate briefly how the law has changed. In 1976, our Supreme Court decided a case where a school bus driver had three accidents within a 47-day period. Two of these were rear-enders. He was probably going too fast for conditions. And another car hit his bus. The department ruled he was not eligible, but the court said he was not disqualified for misconduct because each accident taken separately was just an incident of inadvertence or negligence. Intentional misconduct was what got you denied benefits, not individual errors or mistakes. Well, in 2003, about 27 years later, the Court of Appeals decided a case where a truck driver was fired for breaking a company rule, always use a spotter when backing up a truck. On this occasion, the driver had to move his truck 2 feet to one side, pulling it forward and then reversing. It was pouring rain, he didn't have a spotter, but he had his assistant ride in the back of the truck and pound on the walls if he got too close to anything. Although he did bump a water pipe, he caused no damage to either the pipe or the truck. He was disqualified because the court said he intentionally disregarded a reasonable standard of behavior, even though nothing adverse had happened. The court itself said this was unquestionably a harsh result, and I think that's right. I think the misconduct standard needs to be reviewed because it's changed so much over these 25 years. I don't think workers have changed that much. It's the law that's changed. The consequences of being disqualified from benefits are severe, whether you lose a hearing or you're too discouraged to even ask for an appeal. Under the statute, the unemployed worker who's disqualified has to get another job, earn 8 times their weekly benefit rate, then get separated from a job and apply for unemployment again. I understand that this penalty is there to deter folks from quitting a job just to get half their wages or to punish people who misbehave and get themselves fired. But in this economy, how long does it take to earn enough to work off that disqualification? How do you pay your mortgage or the rent, the electric bill, or the child support without any unemployment benefits? We in legal services have repeatedly seen people who have to give up their housing, move in with family, with friends, with ex-spouses to avoid homelessness when they're denied benefits. Does the process move quickly at least? No, it doesn't. One of my clients was disqualified for quitting a job last June. She'd worked 6 months at a daycare center. She observed what she thought was rough, abusive treatment of some of the little kids. She complained. She saw it happen again, and on a third time, she walked off the job, filed a report with the State Human Services Licensing Department. DHS investigated, found a violation, issued a corrective action order to be posted at the daycare center for 2 years. She applied for benefits in June. The department said in July she quit without a good reason. She appealed, and the hearing was held September 1st. We had the state letter acknowledging that she had made this report. We had the corrective order at the hearing, but we lost. The judge didn't believe her story and said the state investigation report did not prove there was rough treatment of the child. We asked for reconsideration in September. The judge reaffirmed in November. Finally, in November, 5 months after she quit, my client was thrilled to get an $8 an hour job. Up to that time, she and her husband were both living off his disability check. Her case is now pending at the Court of Appeals, probably will be decided by next June. She's never gotten a cent of unemployment. She might get some if the court rules in her favor. There are a lot of folks who are facing poverty because they've been denied unemployment, and that's a fairness issue. There are probably 30,000 to 35,000 folks now out there who have not been able to find work to work off that 8 times their benefit rate disqualification. For them, this penalty means no benefits at all. It's not just a waiting period to deter folks from quitting for no good reason. Both the substantive standard for disqualifying people and the hearing procedures used to resolve these disputes need to be looked at more carefully, so that the changes can be made to make the system more fair so workers have something to rely on when they get unemployed. Thousands of people can't rely on unemployment benefits at all. Thank you.
So, Mr. Thomas, you've been working in this how long? Did you say 20-some years?
I started doing unemployment cases in 1976.
Oh, 30-some years. And, you know, you and I did have a discussion. These changes, these little changes that have occurred over the years have had, in your opinion, a significant impact on the employee having to prove more than they had 2 years ago?
That is the perception I've got over the years, and we see new issues coming up daily. We've now seen three cases where people have been charged with fraud because they didn't answer the questions properly. These are people whose English is not their primary language. And their story was that they thought they were answering the right questions. The standard now says that if you don't have a good faith belief in a statement that you make to the department, that that's fraud. And the judge said, since you didn't know what questions you were answering, that's not a good faith belief. Now, I don't want to defend people who commit fraud, but we're trying to sort some of these cases out, and that's we had not noticed that language in the law, and now that's popping up. So there have been incremental changes every year, it seems like, for the past 15 years or longer. The law has changed. I can't give you a whole list today, but it has changed. A lot more people are being disqualified.
And are these unemployment judges that are making like that decision that you just said, or is that a court of appeals judge in the actual court system?
Well, the courts apply the same law, and if the law they see is clear, they do what it says, even if they say it's harsh, too bad. The appeal time limit is absolute. If someone misses their appeal time by a day, that's it. In that case, that's 15 years ago. But that's so there's no, you can't reopen it if you've got a good reason. You can reopen a security deposit case if you lose it in conciliation court, if you miss your court appearance. If you miss your appeal time on your unemployment benefits, you've lost thousands of dollars. You can't show a good reason. That's just, you know, the way the law is.
So I'm in a car accident, get knocked out, end up in the hospital, don't know where I'm at. My appeals hearing was 2 hours after, you know, before the car accident or whenever after. And
actually, you could probably get your hearing reinstated if you acted within 30 days. So, but if you miss going to the Court of Appeals or your first appeal, you're done for.
Representative Obermiller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to comment on that last exchange there. One of the things we've seen in this unemployment stuff is as Court of Appeals decisions come out adverse, they find someone who we think probably decided shouldn't have gotten benefits and then ultimately did get benefits, and so we're ruling them out or in. We're making little tweaks to the code along the way. And so what that does is you're basically tightening it up to make sure everybody's goal, I think, here is to make sure that people who have done nothing really intentionally or, you know, bad conduct get benefits, and everybody else that is in the camp that did something really bad or wrong doesn't get benefits. But every time we make a little tweak to this thing, we tighten it up and make it a little harder, we catch people not just who did the bad conduct, we catch people who did not bad conduct too. And so we've seen this tweak. I'm in the camp, and I know Mr. Nelson, who's coming up, is in the same camp, that thinks we ought to lay out what the rules are in this statute, make it much more like a code so everybody knows what's in and what's out. But every time we, you know, every time Deed loses on a Court of Appeals case and changes the law a little bit to correct it so that it tweaks into the way that that they think that, you know, it should be, we catch more and more people in these traps. And Mr. Chair, I wanted to follow up. SMRLS is an organization that I think does wonderful work on behalf of people who are trying to get unemployment. And I think, Mr. Thomas, I think you said 700 cases a year, roughly, that you guys are involved in?
Well, we get a lot of requests, a lot of people we can't help if they've missed their time. We turn down cases if we think we're going to lose. We explain to people, you know, you can lose on your own, you don't need our help. But we try to save our time for cases where we can make a difference, and we just tell them. You know, I had a garbage truck driver. The rule said, don't back up, go around the block. Well, he was looking for a promotion, trying to be fast. He had one, you know, garbage can, he just backed up. There was a car in the way, he scraped the hood. That was it. I told him, I'm not going to do your case. You're going to lose. Because there was a clear rule, they knew, I think you're going to lose. And I felt bad about that.
And Mr. Chair, I mean, that's a great example, because there's a person who, through negligence or unintended consequences anyway, ended up violating a rule and maybe deserves to be fired, but doesn't necessarily deserve to have the added penalty of losing their benefits. And the other point, if Mr. Chair, if you just indulge me 1 second, is Smurls gets involved a lot on the Court of Appeals level. When we talk about how many people are, you know, the decisions being made at the unemployment law judge level, and I would just like to know the percentage of cases where Smurls is involved at that level, which I suspect is small.
It's not that many. I didn't take time to run the numbers. I suppose we do 50, 60 hearings a year. I don't know, because we have a bigger office in St. Paul. I'm in Mankato. We don't handle all that many there. So, but a lot of times people have already lost. We do reconsideration requests to get them on the route to the Court of Appeals. There's about 250 people that are going to the Court of Appeals on their own, pro se. And that's just the tip of the group that progressed through the denial process.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just think, I mean, the point we're trying to make is that this is our only hope for trying to get all the right evidence in at the hearing, unless the unemployment law judge is pulling it out of those people like they're supposed to. And they can only do 50 or so a year. And we've got hundreds and hundreds of people who are going through these individual hearings. And so this is an area we've definitely got to do a lot of work on to make sure that people who are fired get fired fine, but they don't also lose they don't have the added penalty of losing their unemployment benefits as well.
Okay, Representative Atkins.
Thank you. And I guess this, at peril of being a conversation that only a lawyer could love, my question for Mr. Martin, for Mr. Nelson, Mr. Thomas, I'm sorry, and Representative Obermiller brought it to mind, is that if you follow the suggestion that was indicated, which is to establish new rules relative to misconduct and set this out so it's more clear. Right now we have a body of law with respect to a whole variety of unemployment situations. My concern would be if we go back to the drawing board and we adopt a new set of rules or legislation, or however we go about doing it, then we got to go back through and for every situation that hasn't been completely identified, we then have a whole bunch more cases coming before the Court of Appeals and making law again. I'd be curious to have the witness and the department comment on whether or not they think that would be worthwhile, because I've toyed with that for now a couple of years, actually, since you, Mr. Chairman, started holding hearings on this topic. Is maybe we would be better off just going back, setting forth some new standards so that those people that lost their job for some reasonable reason still weren't necessarily losing their benefits as an added penalty. But when we start drafting those rules, then don't we just prescribe the need for further interpretation of those rules? And aren't we just going down that path all over again? So I'd be curious hearing from the testifier, but also from Mr. Nelson at the department.
Mr. Thomas, do you want to comment on that for someone who's been involved in this for years and years?
There's always going to be cases at the margins of whatever definition you put forward. There was a definition that had been in use for a period of 20 years or more that pretty clearly distinguished intentional misconduct, kind of a fault thing, from negligence. And again, not saying that someone couldn't do so much negligence that it looked as though they were just as guilty. And that was what the definition said, basically. Look at that. And look more at motive, in a way, than not the facts. We look at the facts, but you also kind of look at the motive. I think the department did not like a subjective type standard. And so that's one of the, you're going to trade off between, you know, how close you want to get to the bad people versus how much time you spend doing it. You'll never write a definition that lawyers are not going to argue about. So I have to say that.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. But I think the point here, Representative Atkins, is what you know, both Representative Obermiller and Mr. Thomas are trying to say, at least in the case of the little tweaks that we've been led to believe, or maybe they have been intended that way, that this is just a technical change. But it's made it harder and harder for people who, you know, just maybe they're, you know, that commercial about that guy that comes in and falls in front of his wife, you know, or trips, or Chevy Chase used to do the imitation of President Ford, who was always tripping over something. I mean, that type of person that just through no fault of their own, is clumsy or whatever and gets fired, and maybe because the company's had enough, but does he deserve then, because of the little tweaks, that this extra added, you know, unintended consequences, I guess. And that's kind of what's happened now. And Representative Wolbermuehl, I think, has been working on looking at some things that it maybe will fix some of what the unintended consequences of some of these changes were. But right now, we're going to bring Mr. Nelson down, and I don't know if Commissioner McElroy wants to come down also. And we still have to get at Mr. Marfis, our first testifier, too, because even though Mr. Marfis said he wasn't on federal extension, I have had a number of calls where people are on a federal extension, are getting 400 or 500 or the maximum a week, in good faith, take a job. They're a 49er, let's say, an operating engineer that's been called back to work, and the nature of their work is, yes, I'm going to go back. I want to make some money, and they, you know, they run a dozer or a whatever piece of equipment and work maybe 3 weeks and get laid off, and that puts them in a qualification where now they can get state unemployment. They qualify for state unemployment insurance, and all of a sudden, because they've only worked a few weeks or whatever, they drop from the federal extension from $400 or $500 a week to, we had a case of a lady, a steel worker up on the range, who took a part-time job because she went by the rules and dropped from 400 and, what is it, Anita, 480 or 40 some dollars a week to $47 a week, and she has two kids and a home and is a single mother. And I think we have to fix this, because I would just as soon, in this terrible depression we're in, you can call it the Great Recession, we're in a depression, use the federal extension and let our citizens use it so they can survive, rather than jump back on the state and go from $440 a week to $47 a week and try to make your house payments and feed two kids. So, Commissioner, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Dan McElroy. I'm Commissioner of the Department of Employment and Economic Development. I think we should begin by addressing issues you've raised, Mr. Marfig's concern and the slip lead concern. I'm going to call on Lee Nelson, who's the Chief Legal Officer for the agency. And I'm hoping we have time to go through a report that we provided, the 2009 Unemployment Insurance Annual Report, and a presentation about that that will put some facts in context of what we're talking about. But because we have witnesses here, very much like to deal with those issues. And so if I could ask Lee to start with this issue of why the law requires someone to start a new account if they've had work experience during their benefit year.
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am Lee Nelson. I'm the Chief Legal Counsel for the Unemployment Insurance Program and to the department. Mr. Chairman, in response to the gentleman's case, that's the way it's worked since 1936. That's the way this program works. The program looks at what work you performed in the last year, and that determines your benefit entitlement. And we have a lot of seasonal employees who apply for unemployment benefits, and their weekly benefit amount is based on the employment they've had in the last year. And if they have less employment in the year, their weekly benefit amount will go down. That's the way it works. We don't look back on a period, what you did 2 years ago or 3 years ago or 4 years ago. We look at what you did in the past year, essentially. It's a little more complicated than that. In regards to the chairman's question about people on a federal extension, federal law provides that you cannot stay on an extension if you qualify for regular state benefits. You have to then go on and collect regular state benefits. Now, what makes it even more complicated is once you exhaust those regular state benefits, then federal law says you can go back on the extension, and that extension may be at a higher weekly benefit amount. As the chairman indicated, and I'm aware of that particular case, I've been talking with Ms. Newman about it and Senator Tomassoni about it. But many people who are on an extension take a job for a relatively short period of time, and then that relatively short period of time they qualify for regular benefits. They have to go on regular benefits. You cannot stay on an extension. I have copies of federal law. That has been the federal law since 1970. This is not new. That's both the original, that's the federal EUC, the latest extension, and here's the other extension in place, which has been in place since 1970. Which I could say about federal law. Federal law says we're not going to pay, federal law says we're not going to use federal funds when state funds are available. And so happens that the Minnesota benefits are then lower. Not much more to say than that. Federal law will not allow Minnesota to, you know, keep paying the extension when someone qualifies for regular benefits. You have to collect those. I spoke with some USDOL people, and their kind of response is Minnesota can do anything it wants. It just isn't going to get the federal money. Minnesota could pay those higher benefits, but then Minnesota would have to pick up the cost for those higher benefits.
Well, Mr. Nelson, first of all, I believe we brought this issue up when we had that jobs hearing, and some of the members, I apologize, weren't on that jobs committee, but we brought the exact issue up of what was happening to people that were, because it was starting to happen then, because some people's year was up, that were going out, taking a job at lower pay, not realizing when they, and if they got laid off, they'd come back and they'd end up, you know, we never saw a case like this where it went from $450 a week to 47 or whatever it was. But we were seeing cases and hearing complaints from constituents where it went, was going from 500 to 300 or 250. And remember, we asked you in Mille Lacs, Representative Downey, you were there. Remember this issue came up? We talked about it. Do you warn people that by taking a job, a low-paid job, you're going to maybe jeopardize the federal extension that you qualify for currently? So did the department do anything in that area in trying to maybe tell a operating engineer, if you go back for just 1 week, you might go from $580 a week to $250?
Mr. Chairman, at that suggestion, we did put information on our website. It's called Frequently Asked Questions, Accepting Work and Future Benefits, and goes through the issues you asked about. If I could have a page make copies, unfortunately, are you able to make some copies? This is what's on the website. Now, each situation is different. We encourage people to call us, but we did take the action of raising that issue on the website so people would be alerted to the fact that if they take a job and make less than they've made in the past, it would affect their benefits.
Well, okay, well, we'll look at that. And Mr. Nelson, isn't there a way that we, and when Representative Mahoney did some things last year, wasn't it to make people qualify for the federal extension in one of his bills where they wouldn't have qualified otherwise? Couldn't we do that by making, you know, the income requirement higher or whatever so they could stay and choose the federal, or choose to stay on the federal extension instead of going back to the state?
Mr. Chairman, members, you could raise the requirements to qualify for regular benefits, but then you're also, some of those people are going to lose. That means you won't qualify for regular benefits. But what if you're not on an extension? So then you don't qualify at all. And you would have to set the thresholds very high. Right now, Minnesota's thresholds to qualify for benefits are relatively low if you look nationally. But if you raise those requirements, you're going to exclude people from collecting benefits.
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, Commissioner.
We don't believe that we can, the federal law would allow us to have a different standard for qualifying for an initial account than you would have for re-qualifying later in the process. Currently, if you make $1,000 in a calendar quarter, you're eligible. And we certainly would be happy to have that discussion if that's an old number and perhaps should be higher, but it does have potentially the unexpected consequence or unintended consequence of depriving other people who do need benefits but haven't made a lot of money. Now, in fairness, if you've only made $1,000, the weekly benefit amount won't be very high.
And that's the, some of the examples that we've seen that were the most egregious examples. Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, members, one of the reasons this occurs is because of the length of the federal extensions. They are unprecedented, never occurred before, or never occurred in the 70s or 80s. And that causes it to be exacerbated. So that's one of the reasons you will see it, and you will see more of it if Congress broadens the extensions. It will occur even more often, and it's occurring in every other state. Minnesota is not unique.
Well, Mr. Nelson and Commissioner, I just think that if the federal extensions are available, we should make sure that our citizens can maximize that extension and not be penalized because they tried to be play by the rules, be good citizens, went back, got a part-time job or a couple of weeks or a month job, and then come back and, you know, drop off that system. And if it has to be a way to look at that wage adjustment or whatever for qualifying for state UI, I mean, you've been around this system, Mr. Nelson, for, well, longer than that attorney has, I think. So, I mean, maybe we'll need the attorney to help us and your expertise to look at what we can do. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a chance to review the materials that you provided on what Minnesota is offering for UI benefits already. And, you know, though it's unfortunate with your constituent at the $47, I think that that's probably an outlier, and maybe, Mr. Nelson, you can address that, because if I'm reading this correctly, Minnesota's average weekly benefit amount is $355. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, that is correct. Currently, last time we ran some figures, is about 12% of all applicants are receiving the maximum. And so you're talking about a broad spectrum when you come up with that average. You're talking about across, you know, 300,000 people. But that is the average individual who collects benefits gets $355 a week. That means they made just over $700 a week average.
And Mr. Chair?
Go ahead.
Mr. Nelson, I don't know if the department has, and I'm going to go a slightly a different direction from the chair. I had an actual constituent contact me, upset. Her son actually is employed in a placement firm, places engineers in different jobs. And what he found frustrating was he would contact an engineer, and all these are people in high-paying jobs, about a job opening, and the engineer would say, well, my unemployment benefits aren't exhausted yet, so I don't want to take any positions. And to him, that was just egregious. And as to me as well, you know, when you have individuals denying good work because they want to be able to max out their unemployment benefits, and I just think of all the people that need those benefits. I just think that's a disservice to this program. And I'm just wondering, is there anything that you've looked into as far as the department goes to address, is there any way to address something like that?
Who wants it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, there is a provision in law that says if you deny an offer of suitable work, you can be disqualified. It doesn't often come to our attention unless it's been offered by a previous employer, for example. And we do hear about the example that you give, usually not at the level of a professional engineer. And I don't know that we hear as much about it in this very difficult economy where it is so hard to find new employment. But we can't always control the decisions everybody makes, and that's an unfortunate decision.
Well, Representative Anderson, my experience with the, and we have literally fielded hundreds and hundreds of phone calls. I think somebody wrote on a bathroom wall, call Rukavina's office if you're unemployment problems, because we're getting,
Mr. Chairman,
you did that at the work site, I think, because our office is just fielding them, and they're coming in from all over, and a lot of them are people that exact opposite. They want to go back to work because a lot of them you make a lot more money working than on unemployment insurance, and it's not a very good economy where, you know, that we're living in anyhow, so they want to go to work. And I just had a person in the painters union, just like this gentleman up here that called me from Duluth, same situation. Went back, got laid off again after 3 or 4 weeks, and because it was a year, had to relook, but they did help with that one. Somebody figured out a way around that. I don't know how they did. Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, you know, I do want to compliment the department that when we have called, and I don't know, I would suspect any other legislator has called, they've really been able to deal with most of these problems. That's a big plus for the department, and I appreciate it. It's unfortunate that we're still having these kind of computer problems after a year or whatever. I'm going to guess that your system was never designed to handle this unprecedented amount of unemployment in the state. Certainly, I, you know, what you've tried over the last year, getting more people to actually be there to actually walk people through, because even still after last year's bill where we did some, Mr. Nelson helped me figure out a way so that when someone is going to school that and they can check that box and know they're not quitting, to find out that we're still having those problems with some of the flight attendants is hard. Drop-down boxes or drop-up boxes or whatever it is on that computer, it's still more and more difficult. And these people are in a pretty bad way. So, I don't know if we can find a solution today. I mean, it's, you fired up a system right in the middle of a crisis, and I'm, you know, I tend to, like, not try and change my TV right before the Super Bowl if I can help it.
Representative
Mahoney, the old system, which was begun in the mid to late 1970s, I'm told would have literally melted down at the volumes that we have today. It was anticipated it would not be able to handle more than 100,000 requests for benefits a week. We are have been north of 200,000 requests for benefits in a number of weeks. As it indicates in the report, and we may have to go through that on another occasion, we are one of the few states meeting all the federal guidelines for timeliness, in part because of the system. But no one would claim it was perfect, and you're certainly correct. It was not. This is outside the design expectation of the system, but we are able, the federal standard is to make 90% of your decisions within, or 88% of the decisions within 14 days. And that often requires mailing things out and getting them back. We're at 90% of decisions within 14 days, and the national average, I think, is about 82%. We will do better, you know, as we continue to develop the system.
Commissioner and Mr. Nelson, I still want to get back to the airline workers and yes. The fact that we did have a meeting in the office with Mr. Nelson and Mr. Goodwin to try to resolve this problem, and that we still have a number of people, including one of the testifiers, who still hasn't gotten, you know, the initial 3 or 4 or 5 weeks that they were 5 weeks that they were due them, I guess. And there's got to be a way to get around that, Mr. Nelson, other than going to, you know, an appeals court or to UI court. And, you know, for the number of cases that we've heard, and I don't know if it's 30,000 or however many, you know, end up going to the UI judges, but half of them are thrown out. I mean, they should have been given their unemployment insurance in the first place, and there's got to be an intermediate step in there that we can figure out where that doesn't even happen, that you don't have to go and hire, because you told me here not recently that you were going to be hiring more UI judges. And, you know, it would seem that if we just had a few more supervisors that maybe could look at the initial decision of refusing someone, and those teams, different teams that you have at your at DEED, maybe we could resolve the problem before then. But regarding the the airline workers. Can we have that discussion?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, as was indicated in testimony, the law was changed last August. The law does require that individuals who take a voluntary leave of absence, and this statute doesn't apply just to Northwest, applies to anyone who takes a voluntary leave of absence under certain conditions, but they still must meet all of the other eligibility requirements in the law. And those requirements are that you be available for work and actively seeking work. And if an individual was asked the question, were you actively seeking work or were you available, and if they indicate no, that's going to indicate a denial.
Yeah, let me just break in here. You know, once in a while we got to have a little common sense. Now, why your department runs the workforce development centers? Am I wrong?
With partners, that's correct.
With partners, and there's a tax on employers like Mr. Gunther and other people that paid it of that little surcharge for that money. Why would we send a stewardess or a excuse me for being politically incorrect. I'm being politically honest and getting upset here. To training when they're going to be back to work in a month and a half. Why would you waste the taxpayers' money doing that? Where's the common sense in that?
Mr. Chairman,
I don't care what the law says. We're all lawmakers around this table. We get to change laws. Do we got to change a law that says if somebody's going to work in a month and a half back to work, they don't have to go to a career change seminar or a workforce center?
Mr. Chairman, we will look into that. I don't know that it takes a law change. What would take a federal law change is the requirement that people be actively looking for work. And we will have a discussion internally about asking people to take training. I think we should offer it to them. I was not aware that we had law judges who required it. We will look into that further, Mr. Chairman. I also was surprised by Ms. Gandrud having difficulty getting unemployment manuals, and we will take care of that. I'm sorry if you have that difficulty. We can get the Red Book is not confidential. We'll get as many as you need.
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You alluded to my question, and I guess it simply, of the percentage of people that are denied unemployment benefits, do you have any data about how many ultimately receive reversal? And do you have any data about the reasons why? Are they overturned at a higher rate for different reasons? I don't know. You know, I guess, is there any information about that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Eastland, you're looking at a couple different issues. If you're looking at a separation from employment or if you're looking at an ongoing issue, you may be ineligible for unemployment, but if it's for 1 week because you weren't available for work that week, then you are eligible for periods after that. So, but if you're looking at a separation from employment, I think you'll see the statistics in here. Only 1 in 5 separation from employment determinations is appealed. And then the reversal rates are set forth. About 60% are appealed by applicants and about 40% by employers. I think the statistics
are in
there.
On page 16 of this PowerPoint or this update,
It shows the separation of 70% of appeals are filed by applicants and 31% by employers. But when an applicant is the appellant, it's reversed a shade more often. But most appeal reversals result because at a hearing you get a whole lot better evidence. You've got testimony, sworn testimony. You may have a conflict in written documents upon which those initial determinations are made. This way you get to provide sworn testimony, witnesses, exhibits. You're going to get a better product. I mean, that's just what's going to occur. That's why you have it here. To the representative's question about inserting another layer in between, the question becomes whether you get a formal process or just an informal internal process. And again, most cases aren't reversed because somebody just says, you know, on the evidence you had, you were wrong. Most of them, you get a whole lot better evidence at a hearing. That's why you have a hearing. Otherwise, you wouldn't need one. That's what happens. I guess that's the process. And that's kind of the way it is in, you know, if you think about it, in a lot of other legal forms, too. That's why we go to trials, if you will, and bring in all the evidence, rather than just some initial submissions.
Mr. Nelson, and maybe Mr. Obermuller, who's been involved in the UI trials, if you want to call them that, it's nearly not a trial. Most people are going in there on their own. And they're all over the phone now, aren't they?
Virtually all of them are over the phone.
Yeah. Well, that's a day in court, all right. Anyway, Representative Norton.
We don't call them trials. We call them hearings. There is some benefit both to workers and the system to have them over the phone. It avoids people having to make a trip someplace and reduces costs. We've gotten, we can, I'd be very hesitant to go away from the phone system because it enables us to get much more timely results. It's certainly not perfect.
Well, I was just, the point being, these aren't really like a trial court or a trial case.
They're an administrative.
And we've heard evidence today that they're pretty arbitrary, too. That one flight attendant is treated one way and one in the same situation is treated another. And so there's obviously no, I don't know, case law, I guess. Is that a good word for it, Representative Obermuller? Involved here. Representative Norton, did you have a question to this issue?
Well, I just want to add to the conversation a little bit, and that is I'm still going to argue that I think that extra person, and maybe it's not for every call. I think there are some that could clearly, when someone has checked the wrong box or, you know, doesn't understand a question, could clearly be helped by a review of the document before it's denied. I think that is a simple step, and I guess my question is, I'm assuming the judges are paid and they don't do this out of the goodness of their heart. Is that correct? And I'm assuming they are paid monthly or hourly or yearly. And I'm also assuming that a person to answer the phone to go over a form would be paid significantly less. And so even if you could only clear up a small portion of them, you would save time on the other end with judges. And that just makes sense to me. And the other comment I just wanted to make is the 1 in 5 only appeal. There are a lot of people who don't appeal because they're terrified of the legal process. They've been turned down. They just walk away from it. And so I would say with the number of denials that we have, if only 1 in 5 are appealing, there's probably, at half of those are being overturned, there's a whole lot more people who could get theirs overturned if this system worked in their favor rather than against them.
Right. Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Norton. Representative Obermuller will attest, unemployment law judges are not paid that much more than the initial determiner. It's not a hiring somebody in the interim level isn't going to save you much that way. I think you might be surprised, and I would gladly meet with you and tell you how much an unemployment law judge is paid. Certainly. Representative Obermuller attempted to do something about that, did not prove successful. So just creating another layer before you go to an unemployment law judge, you know, I don't know that that gets you a better process. You just put more steps in. Are you better going to flatter? You can get right to a hearing rather than I got to go through this step and this step and this step before I can actually talk to somebody about my case, testify about it. We tried to flatten the process, and you'll see that people who file an appeal in Minnesota, 80% get a decision within 30 days. The national average right now is 25%. California, less than 3% of people who appeal get a hearing decision in 30 days. Wisconsin was at 26%. Minnesota, it's at 80. We're one of the fastest in the nation.
Representative Reinert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nelson may have somewhat answered my question with that 80% figure, but my concern was, is there any process by which you can recall your application and make corrections? Short of going to a hearing, is there a time period in which you can review your application, or is there any mechanism in place for people who don't have the computer expertise and inadvertently make an error?
Mr. Nelson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative, once it's submitted, no, you can't go back and find out I've been denied because I did this, and now I want to change my answer. I might make a comment about perceived inconsistencies. When people testify about their search for work, in response, they've initially indicated they weren't looking for work or something similar. You're down to a question of believability. The unemployment law judge, those are the calls they make every day about the testimony that people present. Is it believable? In many hearings, it's conflicted testimony. Lawyers, witnesses testify one way, an applicant testifies another. You have to make a judgment. That's what occurs every day. It's what judges do.
Representative O'Meal, you had a question, but I see one of the flight attendants had wanted to comment. Did one of the flight attendants want to comment on something that was said? Why don't you come down and Representative O'Meal, then we'll just go a little bit over. And Ms. Gandrew, just...
Thank
we're
you.
We're running out of time, so if you could make
this it. This will be really quick, and I apologize for interrupting. With the unemployment rate where it is right now, we just find it questionable and sort of sad that our flight attendants who have 30, 60, 90 days, maybe 4 months, they're going back to work. They're required and mandated to go out and look for a job and take a job from somebody else who doesn't have a start date, who doesn't have a job to go back to. That is another big issue that I wanted to bring to the attention of the members today. And thank you for letting me.
Thank you. And Commissioner McElroy did refer to the federal requirements that you have to be looking for work, but I know in other tough times in the 80s, there was some common sense used in a particular situation like yours. Representative Obermuller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Wrap it up.
I think we've talked about a lot of great issues here. For whatever reason, I find this area of the law very interesting. But so I intend to bring forward, I've got some
you
ideas
twist
here.
It.
I think that might be right. I want to thank Mr. Nelson and Commissioner McElroy for answering all the questions I've had over the last year on this topic. And I think I have a couple ideas I'm going to be bringing forward, I think, in the next couple weeks here. But because there are things I think we can fix, especially to the point that we've really been hitting on today about trying to keep people at their high benefit level. I mean, state law controls things like when we pay and how we pay. And so to the extent that we can change our state law and fix it so that we can benefit ourselves by having our employees who are unemployed through no fault of their own getting these federal extension benefits, we have to do that. I think we've got to talk about employment misconduct. That Mr. Thomas talks about that and how that's narrowed down, so pretty much anything that you get fired for can be employment misconduct these days. That's an area we're going to work on. I know Mr. Nelson's committed to helping me with that, working on that issue. But this is not the last time you guys get to hear about this, my new favorite topic of Minnesota law.
Well, members, with that, you know, and I really do want to, Commissioner, I have to tell you, Mr. Nelson has helped me out on a number of occasions with individuals. But, pardon me.
Me too.
And everyone, I think. But there is just seems too many people that shouldn't have to come to their legislator. I know Representative Mahoney's gotten help and others, Representative Norton. And you know, what about the employees out there that don't know enough to come and ask? And when they do come, and I've had some come after that appeals process is over when it's too late, and I say, why didn't you come to me before? But that's not the way it should have to work.
Mr. Chairman, we encourage them. They're welcome to call you. They can call my office, and they do.
I like them calling me, and then I can harass you, Commissioner.
Well, and you can.
You know, works better, that process. But the fact of the matter is they shouldn't have to come to any legislator at all. They should be able to go into that office, which we've tried to do for 3 years, and get a human being to help them wade through the system.
And, Mr. Chairman.
And I know you put some of that federal money to put people in those workforce centers, but I think during these tough times, we could have a few more. You do have some of that discretionary money, I know, that maybe we could look at putting a few more people out in the workforce center. So we'll be working with you on this. Mr. Marfus, I just want to say publicly, there's, you know, if you're entitled to something, you should be able to get as much as you're entitled to. And maybe your case was a little different than what we had thought as far as having to reapply on the state system and ending up getting less. Your situation might have been a little different, but we've had many situations called to our attention like that, Commissioner, and we want to maximize that federal extension in these tough times. That's what it was for, and if we can get Minnesota citizens some federal money, that it's their money too, we want to do that.
Mr. Chairman, we certainly will work with you. We need to do that carefully so we don't make it harder for other people to collect. But Representative Obermueller is very aware of those issues, and we'll work with him on some language.
Okay. And members, before I adjourn, then I just want you to know we're going to cancel Thursday because of the governor's speech, and then we have a caucus afterwards, and we just didn't want to end up coming here an hour late and have people waiting around for that hearing on Thursday. So we're going to cancel the hearing, and if you do have any ideas on jobs bills for the economy, and I'd get them in right away because we want a hearing on them and maybe get them out on their own if we can. Okay? Meeting adjourned.